when we think about equanimity, for many of us, we were first intensely introduced to it through the Brahmavihara practice, the loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity practice. In this regard, equanimity is a state of mind where as a response to life, we're mindful towards life as a mindful. I'm sorry, the metta part, that loving kindness part. I didn't say that so well, so I'm repeating it. The loving kindness part of life, the metta part of life, is like an ever flowing fountain. It's a stream. It's this Peruvian stream that just flows. It's a radiating metta. The Buddha describes it in Majjhima, in that early part of the Majjhima Nikaya, and it has a feeling of caring, friendliness, open-heartedness, availability, this metta. Karuna, the compassion feeling in terms of the Brahmaviharas, is a responsive flow. It is not one is flowing, responding to suffering with compassion. It's, to me at least, distinct between metta, which is not you're showering someone with metta, no matter the conditions of their experience. You're having metta towards yourself. If you're in a good mood or a bad mood, or it's pleasant what's happening or unpleasant, the metta is there. It's a caring. It's a friendliness towards, friendliness towards ourselves and others. It's a caring towards ourselves and another. Karuna is response, because one sees suffering. The vibration of the heart, the Buddha said. It's a heart response in the face of suffering, ours and others. And then with sympathetic joy, the feeling again is responsive. It comes about when you see that someone is happy, and you can have happiness for their happiness. In modern times, I have not heard this until recently. I don't dispute it. It's just not the way I've ever taught it, that one can also be happy for one's own happiness, and therefore, and why that is, hearing this mentioned now, is sometimes one can have such a, I'm not worthy of happiness, oh, it's not fair that I'm happy, and the people I know aren't, or someone I know isn't happy, my significant other, or the world, or people in the world, or all of these kinds of things. And so that one would have this, would find permission to one's own state of well-being, when there are states of well-being coming from wholesome goals and skillful means, one would be able to accept one's own sense of well-being. And that if one can't do that, then one would apply sympathetic joy to oneself. I find some wisdom in that as an understanding. And then we get to upekkha, this equanimity, that this equanimity that in the loving kindness does not move towards the object. It's not flowing towards the object in the same way, but it is, its vibration is one of steadiness, of an equilibrium, that one has a kind of it's often described as neutrality, but I think of it as evenness, feeling, that allows us to be able to, if one does not have equanimity, when one gets lost in the metta, one starts coveting rather than just loving, or one becomes indifferent. And likewise with compassion, one falls into, without equanimity, one falls into pity or into a kind of cynicism, a kind of indifference in the face of the suffering. And so compassion would be lost. And again, with loving kind, with sympathetic joy, one without equanimity, one would fall into a kind of envy or jealousy, or one would fall into a kind of just a general resentment or indifference to the happiness of another. So equanimity is a key part of the Brahma Viharas, in my experience, and it is a quality of mind heart that can be cultivated. One can examine if one has equanimity in a given moment, how much equanimity, and deliberately create conditions where there can be more equanimity through reflecting on various things, such as like, this is every, like anicca, one reflects on anicca, one reflects on dukkha, these various characteristics that the Buddha teaches, and many, many other things to reflect that helps build equanimity. One can observe that any kind of over-identification, over-tilting out of balance, because equanimity is that thing that allows us to come back into balance. Without having something that allows us to come back in balance, that just our whole way of using mindfulness in daily life won't work either. And so it's at that point we go to the first thing we looked at was the use of equanimity in relation to Brahma Viharas. This part we're looking at it in relation to mindfulness in the four establishments of mindfulness of the Satipatthana Sutta. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the pleasant and unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling tone, mindfulness of mind states and emotions arising in that mind state, and then mindfulness of the Dhammas, the Buddha's teachings for how we look at those first three experiences of body and pleasant and unpleasant and mind states and emotions, so that we see that that equanimity plays such a key role. Equanimity becomes a part of the awakening factors. It is an awakening factor, and the awakening factors are used all along, starting with mindfulness, by the way. Again, this bookend of mindfulness and of equanimity. And for these awakening factors mature, they are pretty far along in our practice for them to really start to mature and be in line. So very important in the gaining of insight that allows us to let loose of grasping, of tanha, of thirst, of this contracting into, of closing down the heart, of creating the other as enemy. All of these everyday and high-level Dharma teaching ways that equanimity is so important. For me, going through that process, and again, I learned this from, done in a very different way, but by the Venerable Anālio, that going through this process of really arriving into the moment, I'm much more likely to have equanimity if I'm actually present. Otherwise, I'm not paying attention, and so my nervous system will be reactive all on its own because I'm not really there. I'm not participating in the moment. I'm not in that moment dancing with life because I'm absent. So irritation can arise so easily, or judging mind or comparing mind can just jump right in there. So with but if we start with the mindfulness that we know we're arriving, utilizing mindfulness, and we're arriving in this moment so that we can participate in this moment. We have choice in the moment. We have choice that allows us to choose how we're going to respond what's in the moment. That basis of that, and when we have to align with something larger than our ego do what it wants to do for its own reasons. Often which are coming from stories which are really old stories in us, and they're not really even current stories, but they've been there so long, they're the ones that if we're not attending, those stories get to rule the day. Or just because something's pleasant or unpleasant, that rules the day. Or we've been taught to believe something and we don't believe it anymore, but in that given moment, since we're not present and we believed it so long, we act on the basis of that belief. We say something that's not who we are now, or we take some action that we would never take if we were really being present. And so that this being able to be available and aligned in this way gives us equanimity. When we're starting, though, sometimes we need the equanimity to be able to get settled down. Oh boy, I'm sitting here in my morning meditation, and I'm so worried about this thing that's going to happen at work. It's like I can't really feel present. And so ordinarily in your practice, well, then what are you going to do? And what I would ordinarily say would be to just, okay, be present with not being able to be present. Be curious with that. Have equanimity towards that. All of which is right back to where we are. To be okay that you can't be present, but know that you can't be present. Well, there I go again. There I go again. Well, bounce, 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 bounce. And it's okay because the compassion and the equanimity allow that to be okay. And that's how we get grounded to start our day, however difficult that day may be or that one event in our day. So we're utilizing this equanimity in this way of regular mindfulness, using the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness, four establishments of mindfulness, and then in our Brahmavihara practice. And we know we're using it. We know we're using it. Equanimity in the second of the four establishments of mindfulness, which is this the Buddha instructs us to be aware of that there's pleasant and there's unpleasant, and there's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. That neither pleasant nor unpleasant has a feeling of equanimity in it, but as we cultivate equanimity, we can have the pleasant and have equanimity. We can have the unpleasant and have equanimity, even if it's difficult, even if it's a lot difficult. We can still have that as we go. And so this understanding of noticing whether there's something that's pleasant or unpleasant, or is there a kind of that we're equanimous in relation to it, turns out to deepen in all sorts of ways. And one discovers that by living it, not just in the sitting meditation or walking meditation, but also in how we meet our life, how we meet our life. So here I am on the phone with this person, and this, you know, this is definitely not pleasant. But does it have to fall into unpleasant? Maybe. If it falls into unpleasant, can I be okay with unpleasant? That's equanimity. But many times, it's not pleasant, but we don't get into our reactive mind. So we don't collapse into that or fall into that unpleasantness. So we have equanimity. We're equanimous about it. They're being difficult, and we meet their difficulty with patience and persistence. But we don't get entangled in it. And this is one of these key teachings of the Buddha, that we get entangled in our experience, and that's why our greed and our aversion and so forth arise, because we get entangled, we get identified in such a way that it messes us up. And so we're more and more, in terms of we have this base of equanimity. We can be knocked off and come back. It can be unpleasant, and that's okay. It can be pleasant, but we don't go, oh God, I've got to have this. We have a ground here that we're meeting our experience with in this way. So useful to us. And the alignment, being aligned with something larger, so helps us in our worldly goals, where we're either having wholesome goals or unwholesome goals, and whether we're either being skillful or unskillful in the means that we're seeking our goals. And the more equanimity, the more we will choose wholesome goals, and because there's more room for wisdom. And then likewise, the more we will be skillful in what we choose, because we're not so desperate. We're not, leaning into it or trying to get away from it. We're just here. There's a kind of stillness of the knowing. That's part of that being grounded in the body, that the body consciousness that we spend a lot of time thinking about. And so we have this appreciation of equanimity. The world right now is challenging in so many different ways for people to have equanimity. The pandemic is part of that. It takes people away from equanimity. I call it the COVID undertow. I think I mentioned that when I was here the last time with Marin Sangha. The COVID undertow is the way the mind-body has gotten so affected by this pandemic and the way with our isolation and the uncertainty and all, that it's like the undertow at the beach when you go, you're there swimming in the water right near the shore, actually, but suddenly you discover you're way down the shore. It's the undertow that's pulling you, and it's not visible from the surface, and it's not even so easy to feel, but there's an undertow. And that right now in our society, I speak about this a lot, that there is this COVID undertow, that friends aren't getting along. Someone that you really care for suddenly irritates you. You feel inadequate. You're kind of disassociated about what you care about. All COVID undertow. And you can be yourself not so seemingly affected by it, but then those around you are affected by that undertow, all of these conditions combining to create the undertow. And you feel yourself being affected by their being subject to the undertow, the COVID undertow. And then maybe you've got equanimity and compassion about that. You go, wow, boy, they're really being affected. I'm so glad I'm not being affected. And then after some hours, days, weeks, you discover, whoa, I'm a little disoriented. I, too, am being affected by this. I can feel a certain degree of impatience, now what's my orientation now? That sort of thing. Equanimity allows all the experiences to be seen with mindfulness, because the equanimity allows us to stay present with it rather than getting lost in our reactivity. We stay present long enough to recognize, oh, these are impartial conditions that are affecting. I've worked with so many people about this during this last year and a half. So many people. So many uses like this. The second part about equanimity in terms of the Satipatthana Sutta, this four establishments of mindfulness. That second Satipatthana, about the Vedana, it's called the pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. There's a worldly that we've just gone through, but a world unworldly, where we feel the pleasantness of things that are not about getting or getting rid of or any of that, but just that they have an uplifting quality, a kind of liberating quality, a kind of feeling of getting free from being caught. And the equanimity that arises at that level, there's times it's very pleasant, but there's times when there is a kind of neutral feeling to it, because one is so, say for instance, you're seeing a Nietzsche so strongly that even the feeling of pleasant just doesn't apply somehow. Even though you're in this really like elevated state, but to call it pleasant wouldn't be right. But it's certainly not unpleasant. But there's a that spiritual quality of, you know, an example of this can sometimes be like the bliss of blamelessness, which was talked about in the sutta. I encourage you to just notice, like maybe today, because of the storm, if you're here in the Marin area, the storm has kept you inside and away from the power was out. You didn't talk to anybody on the phone. Anyway, you can sit here and go, I don't think I've been unskillful all day. And it feels so good to not feel any kind of feeling of that. That's called the bliss of blamelessness. And that's part of why the ethical part, sila part of practice is so big. That bliss of blamelessness, when the mind really feels free, it doesn't feel so connected to time space anymore. And so therefore it doesn't have that pleasantness in the same way. But the neither pleasant nor unpleasant is onward leading. It's got its own, but it just doesn't. You're in a different a sphere of your experience, and maybe some of you have had this a number of times in your life, even as growing up, but never had it named in a way that you would recognize it. So these are some of the feelings around equanimity. There's one sutta where the Buddha, Sariputta, who is one of the primary colleagues of the Buddha in terms of his teaching, and oftentimes when the Buddha would come to a village, he would say, Sariputta, you teach the Dhamma, I need to rest. Things like that. And so Sariputta, in this one sutta, is given a teaching to, in the sutta it refers to the monks, or at least it's not so clear exactly. But anyway, this one monk keeps interrupting Sariputta and saying things that just aren't true, and saying, no, that's not right, Sariputta, and all this. And the Buddha's chief attendant, Ananda, is sitting there listening to this. And he's very equanimous. And so he doesn't say anything. He doesn't interrupt this. He doesn't stop this disruption that's going on, where this monk is making false claims against one of the most senior monks. So that one would, in terms of keeping what is real and what's not real, you know, that it's, you may be familiar with this in current times, where misinformation is being stated, and Ananda didn't do anything. And later the Buddha says to him, but Ananda, having equanimity in the face of a senior monk being mislabeled that there's no compassion in that. So yeah, you should intervene. You should have stopped that monk. You should have said to the whole crowd, you know, to the whole gathering, no, this person is stating things that are not true, that this is not, and Sariputta is teaching us the Dhamma. And I found that very interesting. I am in my own reflection, my own exploration about that. And I make this point, though, because we have equanimity, it doesn't mean that we abandon our values. It doesn't mean that we abandon our caring. So we're not, it's not equanimity as a indifference. That would be a deterioration of the equanimity. And that would come from too much caring one way or the other, you know, as a negative, an aversive way, or a wanting in some way where you you just kind of give all that up and I don't care about anything. It doesn't matter. It all changes anyway. That attitude is not what the Buddha means, as I understand it, by equanimity. So having given this wide-ranging orientation to equanimity, and having invited you to explore it directly in your meditation, if it's okay with Marin Sangha leadership, I'd actually like to spend the rest of this time taking some questions in regard to equanimity. Is that suitable and acceptable? Okay, Liz.
Hi there. I wish I had heard this talk 5 years ago. Because up until about 3 months ago, I don't know what happened, I always did not believe in equanimity other than as a state to be achieved through working with the Brahma Viharas and meditation. So I felt that equanimity would be a spiritual bypass. This is what I thought. And I even remember telling Sally, I don't believe in equanimity. And you know what I'm like. So one of my famous pronunciation mantras. And recently, I don't know why, perhaps I'm studying to be a teacher, so I'm opening my mind up more, beginner's mind. It occurred to me I could choose, and you said it. I was waiting for you to say choose. I could choose equanimity. And I don't know why it's taken so long, because I didn't understand that one could do that. I thought it was a result of practicing.
Well, thank you for that. And you're pointing to a very widespread view of distrust of equanimity, that it means that we are being available to be pushed around, taken advantage of. We have to have this kind of fire to respond, and we do need a kind of fire, but it's not the kind of where it's because of lack of equanimity. It comes from our conviction. The fire comes from conviction, the clarity of our thinking, the steadiness of what we are aligned with. You know, and another thing that you bring up with that is this: when I point to availability, people will often you arrive in the moment and you feel you're now present. You have mindfulness with enough steadiness that you can align with something. People will sometimes feel like, I can't be available till I've aligned with something. It's not safe. I can't have that, because the being available, and you have choice. There's a degree of equanimity right there, you see. And people can say, well, no, it seems like we should arrive and then align and then be available. And yes, that's true. But there that little step in between, the first time you arrive and be available, you're being, that first availability is to have choice. because we if we don't realize we have choice, aligning doesn't happen very well. We don't really get lined up, and there's that moment of being available. That first time we're available to choose, that we need some equanimity right there, because in our past we may have been available in various ways, and people sort of took advantage of us because we weren't, we had not aligned, we'd not owned our power, we'd not aligned with the Dhamma, we'd not aligned with our own self worth, all of these different ways of understanding it, and so we go, that doesn't feel safe to me. I need first to align so that I can be vulnerable in that way, and that's true enough. But it's a little tricky. That choosing can be realizing we do have choice is, in my own understanding, is empowering in and of itself, and it's the kind of empowering that allows us to align. But it's also the very same kind of empowering if we were being, accosted in some way with, oh, you know, I should have this, you should give me that. But right there in that very moment, because we feel the power of choice, we realize we have choice. And if we were going to react, I mean, we're in the mode of choice. And knowing we have choice is empowering. And knowing we have choice gives us equanimity. Do you follow me? And so it's we're in a wholesome spiral or circle, however you want to see that. And then when we align with what we, you know, the Dhamma, whatever we're aligning with in our lives, and I mean this quite literally, that we live in a, and to live an intentional life, you have to be aligned with something. So and mindfulness without intention has no purpose. You know, it's just subject to the whim of the moment. But intention without mindfulness has no way to operate. So they're really right there together. I'm really pointing to a kind of key structure here in this. And so anyway, that gives us for you, Liz, you realize, oh, yeah, I do have this choice, and I do. It's not weak. It's actually claiming my strength, my right to be strong. It's a major reconfiguration for many people. Okay, let's see. Rory, is that? I don't have my glasses on. Am I reading it?
Yes. Hi. Yeah. Thank you for the talk, Philip. It was great. I'm a little bit of a newbie, so I'm going to take a shot here.
Sure.
So I'm kind of a nervous person. So what I hear you saying, let's say I just had a new knee put in. So I had the knee put in, and then something else happened, and then something else happened. And today I went to the freezer and it was overfrosted, which could put me into like, so now I'm thinking what really went on there about the freezer was a story, I think, of the past about how things always happen to me, or I'm alone by myself. I can't do it. Whatever it is, it's just a story where I could have paused. I'm assuming I could have paused and created some sort of equanimity about what had happened that would have been a lot more real than the story. Does that make sense?
Yes, because in your story, you were giving away your power. You already had a freezer problem, but now you have a problem in your mind too. So now you've got an extra problem. Today I discovered that all of this time and money I spent to fix this leak, which I kept questioning the way they were fixing it, and they were saying you just don't understand about fixing these things. That in fact it's leaking again, and I watched me start to go to a story of having been disrespected, having not been with the caring that I gave them, I had like two or three candidates just like you, and I was going, it's a leak, I'll deal with it as best I can when I can. Huh. In the meantime, put towels out, just deal with the leak right now, and then deal with the fixing it later, and just leave the story out. And that equanimity saved me from a whole series.
Other stories. Yeah. Thank you for that.
That's great that you're seeing that.
Yeah, thank you.
You're most welcome. Linda.
So I'm struggling a bit with this idea that you put out about having equanimity with not having equanimity.
Yes.
And not grokking it.
Okay. I appreciate you asking that because, you know, I will say those things and if nobody says anything, then I'm going to go right on and you got to figure it out for yourself over time. So I appreciate your asking. So what would be your strategy if you're in a situation and you just don't have any equanimity about it? You are, you know, it could be, a personal situation, say, and you know, something needs to be done and, you know, yeah, really, it's agitating. That's the way it is now is really agitating. And you're falling into that agitation and it's a legitimate need, but you're meeting that with agitation and you don't seem to have any choice. So then what would be your strategy? What's wise effort?
I was really agitated, I'd probably go for a walk.
But you see, that's to get yourself calmed down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm pointing to here is that sometimes we can't calm down. Or we're stuck in a situation and there's going to be some period of time being mistreated by the airlines can do that to you when you're sitting there and you're in this little tight container and these people next to you and even in the best of times, non-COVID times, can be we can be agitated in a way that right now the mind can't settle down. So there's a difference between then turning on ourselves because the mind can't settle down, you know, like, or taking that energy and doing something unwholesome with it, versus going, oh, I'm lost in this. So when we know we're lost in it and we're being mindful of being lost in it, then we are at least wishing, we have a hint of equanimity. We have the direction of equanimity. We have a kind of a belief in the through line of that equanimity will arise. We're aligning with something in that way. We're using our practice to help us be with a difficult moment when we've lost it. So we've lost it, but we don't have to get totally lost in it. That's what I'm pointing to. We just go, okay, I will bear this till there's choice. That is my choice, that I will consciously bear it. So, and I'm not, but I don't have equanimity. My mind's still going, you know. There was another construction thing there's a construction project that's going on next door to me that's gone on for 3 years. And I went through a little period there where I was not able to be with my discomfort. You know, I was judging myself. That did not help in any way. And because it didn't lead, you see, it wasn't onward leading. It wasn't wholesome. It was just leading me into story. It was making story deeper rooted in me. But when I finally realized, you know, this too. And then, although I still was agitated for a while, then it went less. And it takes more and more things to agitate me about this now because I got to an equanimity with my lack of equanimity. That's where I had to start from. I could not start from equanimity.
I like that I will bear this until I have a choice. That kind of gives some hope to the situation and... Yeah, we
have to find some way to name this to ourselves. Otherwise, it sounds like maybe some strange idea that I'm not ready for yet. But so sometimes we can evoke equanimity, and other times we cannot. But we can have the acknowledgement of equanimity, the hint, just like with loving kindness, or forgiveness practice. You know, we can't forgive, but we can know that it is our aspiration to forgive. Or it's our aspiration to have the aspiration. We wish we had the aspiration. Any turning towards the wholesome. And I use this a lot, and I don't know if people know how literally I mean this. Any turning repeatedly towards the wholesome has this huge effect over the period of time. I'm going to go on here and Ron, and then we have to stop and end. So thank you, Linda. Ron.
Thank you, Linda, and thank you, Philip. I think this is my first Zoom Marin Sangha, and I found my body moving while you were talking, just no particular intention, but I just found it swaying or stretching or doing a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I had the sense, a different sense of equanimity than I've had before, and I wonder what your thoughts might be about it, in which I was thinking about equanimity not as a state of balance exactly, but more like being on a tightrope with one of those long bars so that you're constantly off balance one way or another, and you're doing adjusting in a moment of time. And I wonder any thoughts about that, either somatically or
so. In the what he's saying is like his equanimity or in a way stillness versus movement in relation to something, and it's both. So equanimity, you can get knocked off, but then you just come back. It's got the ability to, you're not perturbed by perturbances, although perturbances are happening. So if someone pushes you and you come back, you're unsettled, and well, you go, what was that? And then you're back. So yes, movement is perfectly fine as part of that. And sometimes that movement, like when you're sitting, it doesn't work to sit in a group and move all, but sometimes in the sitting, the movement is the way you are actually calming. And there is a difference between the calming and the awakening factors. Calm is its own factor, that your mind's totally calm, it's still, versus equanimity, where it's balanced. So there's that difference between that balance, and the balance is not static alone. Sometimes when you're in a deep state, it's very static, but oftentimes there is movement, and the movement is informed by the practice, informed by what you're aligned with, informed by your practice to date. Did that answer the question for you?
That was very good. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to end with a poem. It's a little long, but it's not forever long. It's by Naomi Shihab Nye, and it's called Sifter, like sifting, you know what a sifter is. When our English teacher gave us our first writing invitation of the year, become a kitchen implement in two descriptive paragraphs, I did not think butcher knife or frying pan. I thought immediately of soft flour showering through the little holes of the sifter and the sifter's pleasing circular swishing sound, and wrote it down. Rhonda became a teaspoon, Roberta a funnel, Jim a muffin tin, and Forrest a soup pot. We read our paragraphs out loud. Abby was a blender. Everyone laughed and acted giddy. But the more we thought about it, we were all everything in the whole kitchen, drawers and drainers, singing teapot and grapefruit spoon with serrated edges. We were all the empty cup, the tray. This, said our teacher, is the beauty of metaphor. It opens doors. What I could not know then was how being a sifter would help me all year long. When bad days came, I would choose my, I'm sorry, when bad days came, I would close my eyes and feel them passing through the tiny holes. When good days came, I would try to contain them gently, the way flour remains in the sifter until you turn the handle. Time, I was a sweet sifter in time, and no one ever knew. Sifter. Isn't that a form of equanimity? Sifting, meeting our experience with choice, and let it be porous is the word I use. I've often described that. So may that be an inspiration to all of us in our week, and may our week be a week of mindfulness, of arriving, being available and aligning at least once a day, if not numerous times in a day. May we cultivate an inquiry form, just exploration, equanimity.